The burning hull of a Apepi's royal barge drifted up onto the river bank opposite the Temple of Harpy. In the dawn, the smoke rose high into the still air. It was tainted by the stench of burnt flesh. When Mintaka awoke, the smell had penetrated into the cabin and sickened her. The smoke seemed to act like a beacon, for the sun had hardly risen above the eastern hills before the fleet of Lord Najar came sweeping round the bend of the river. The slave girls brought the news to Mintaka.
"Lord Najar has come in full array," they told her excitedly. "Yesterday he left us to return to Thebes. Is it not strange that he could reach here so soon when he should be 20 leagues upriver?"
"Surpassing strange," Mintaka agreed grimly. "I must dress and be ready for whatever new atrocity waits me." Her baggage had all gone up in flames in the royal barge, but her maids borrowed clothing from the other noble ladies in the fleet. They washed and curled her hair, then dressed her in a simple linen shift, gold girdle and sandals. Before noon an armed escort came aboard the galley, and she followed them on deck. Her eyes went first to the blackened timbers of the royal barge that lay on the far bank, burnt down to the waterline. No effort had been made to recover any bodies from the wreck. It was her family's funeral pyre. The Hyksosian tradition called for cremation, not embalmment and elaborate funeral procedures and ceremonials. Mintaka knew that her father would approve of the manner of his own going, and this gave her some small comfort. Then she thought of Kayan, and averted her eyes. It was with an effort that she held back further tears as she went down into the waiting for Lucca, and was taken to the bank below the Temple of Harpy. Lord Najar was waiting with all his company assembled to meet her. She remained aloof and pale when he embraced her. "This is a bitter time for all of us, Princess," he said. "Your father, King Apepi, was a mighty warrior and statesman. In view of the recent treaty between the two kingdoms, and the combining of this very Egypt into one sacred and historical whole, he leaves a dangerous gap. For the good of all, this must be filled immediately." He took her hand and led her to the pavilion, which had last evening been the scene of feasting and festivity, but where now were assembled in solemn conclave most of the nobility and officialdom of both the kingdoms. She saw Trok in the forefront of the throng. He was a striking figure in full regimentals. He wore his sword on a gold-studded belt and carried his war-bow over his shoulder. Behind him in packed ranks were all his officers, grim, cold-eyed and menacing, despite the gay ribbons plaited in their beards. They stared at her unsmilingly, and she was bitterly aware that she was the last of the Apepi line, abandoned and unprotected. She wondered to whom she could appeal, and whose loyalty she still commanded. She searched for friendly, familiar faces in the multitude. They were all there, her father's counsellors and advisers, his generals and comrades in the battlefield. Then she saw their eyes slide away from her face. None smiled at her or returned her scrutiny. She had never felt so alone in her life. Najar led her to a cushioned stool at one side of the pavilion. When she sat down, Najar and his staff formed a screen around her, hiding her from view. She was certain that this had been deliberately arranged. Lord Najar opened the conclave with a lamentation for the tragic death of King Apepi and his sons. Then he launched into a eulogy of the dead pharaoh. He recounted his numerous military triumphs and his feats of statesmanship, culminating in this participation in the Treaty of Hathor, which had brought peace to the two kingdoms torn by decades of internecine warfare and strife. "Without King Apepi or a strong pharaoh to guide the affairs of the Lower Kingdom, and to rule in conjunction with Pharaoh Nefertiti and his regent in Thebes, the Treaty of Hathor is in jeopardy. A return to the horrors and warfare of the last 60 years prior to the treaty is unthinkable." Lord Trok beat his sword scabbard against his bronze buckler and shouted, "Bakir! Bakir!" Immediately the applause was taken up by all the military commanders behind him and spread slowly through the entire assembly
until it was a deafening thunder. Nadja let it continue for a while, then held up both arms. When silence fell, he continued. In the tragic circumstances of his death, King Apepe leaves no male heir to the crown. Smoothly he passed over any mention of Mintaka. As a matter of urgency, I have consulted the senior councillors and gnome governors of both kingdoms. Their choice for the new pharaoh has been unanimous. With one voice, they have asked Lord Trok of Memphis to pick up the reins of power and take the double crown upon himself and steer the nation forward in the noble tradition set by King Apepe. The silence that followed this announcement was profound and drawn out. Men looked at each other in blank astonishment, and only then became aware that while they'd been absorbed in Lord Nadja's address, two regiments of the Northern Army, commanded by and loyal to Trok, had come silently out of the palm groves and surrounded the assembly. Their swords were sheathed, but every gloved hand was on the hilt. It would take a moment only to draw the bronze blades. An air of dismay and consternation fell upon them all. Mintaka seized the moment. She sprang off the stool where she had been hidden and cried, "My lords and loyal citizens of this very Egypt!" She got no further. Four of the tallest Hyksosian warriors crowded round her, hiding her. They rattled their drawn swords against their shields and shouted in unison, "Long live Pharaoh Trok Uruk!" A shout was taken up by the rest of the army. In the joyous uproar that followed, strong hands took Mintaka and spirited her away through the cheering press. She struggled ineffectually, her movements smothered and her voice unheard in the storm of cheering. On the riverbank she twisted in the arms of her captors and glanced back. Over the heads of the crowd, she glimpsed Lord Nadja raising the double crown over the head of the new pharaoh. Then she was hustled down the bank to the waiting felucca and back to her locked and guarded cabin on board Lord Trok's galley.